Welcome to you all to the Graduate and Faculty Christian Forum. My privilege this afternoon to introduce the speaker, Professor Dennis Danielson. But before I do so, I have a few comments to make about the Graduate and Faculty Christian Forum. First and most important thing, before I tell you what it is that there is a sign-up sheet. Please sign up, and then we'll tell you what it's all about. The purpose of the Graduate and Faculty Christian Forum is to provide a space at the university where faith and scholarship can be shared, where there's an interaction of persons seeking and wishing to share their sense of the interaction between scholarship and faith. Our speaker this afternoon is one of the founding members of this forum. Mr. Anderson was here in 1988 together with a small group of faculty members who were concerned about the opportunity to share with their work and scholarship and the perception from their faith. And so the forum is now almost 20 years old, and we're delighted to see a good turnout this afternoon. The next talk in the series of the Graduate Faculty Christian Forum will be given by Professor Bert Cameron in the Faculty of Medicine. And there is a handout at the back of the room indicating the topic, The Role of Christianity in the Development and Prospect of Western Medicine. And this will take place on Tuesday, February the 27th at 4 o'clock in this room. So please make a note of that. And incidentally, my name is Olaf Schleimacher, and I'm an emeritus professor from the Department of Geography here. Now, Dennis Danielson's name is well known on the campus and elsewhere. He's a professor of English, and he came to UBC via the University of Victoria, where he completed his bachelor's degree. He then studied intellectual history at the University of Sussex and English literature at Oxford and Stanford. Until the mid-90s, his main field was 17th century English literature with an emphasis on Milton. He published a couple of books, both Milton, a Good God, and the Cambridge Companion to Milton, and both of these with Cambridge University Press. He's most well known now for his active research linking the humanities and the sciences, and his work on the history of cosmology has received attention in both scientific and popular media. His anthology of cosmological writings, which I presume every one of you has a copy, there are copies available to purchase if you wish to complete your library. This is the Book of the Cosmos, Imagining the Universe from Heraclitus to Hawking, published in 2000 and was named to the Amazon.com Editor's Choice Top 10 Science Books of the Year for 2000. And shortlisted for the Canadian Science Writers Association Science in Society Award. For the year 2002, Dennis was a distinguished scholar in residence at the Peter Wall Institute for Advanced Studies, and an award that helped him pursue his interdisciplinary study of Copernicus and his influence. Professor Danielson has, in recent years, published in Nature, the American Journal of Physics, Journal for the History of Astronomy, and his most recent book, The First Copernican, Georg Joachim Rheticus, and the Rise of the Copernican Revolution, the first ever biography in English of the discoverer and only apostle of Copernicus, has just appeared. So as I say, it's an honor to introduce Dennis, and we look forward to your talk.
Olaf, thank you very much for a kind introduction, and thanks to all of you for coming. So almost 20 years. It's been wonderful to be part of the Graduate and Faculty Christian Forum, and I don't know whether I'll make it for another 20 years, but it's been a lot of fun, and I think highly worthwhile on this campus as well. Why Copernicus matters. This afternoon I'd like to explain in part why Copernicus matters to me and why I think he matters today in more broadly human and cultural terms. My emphasis will be threefold: science, religion, poetry. Three things that also matter a lot to Copernicus. But I also want to include a narrative thread. In recent years, after spending most of my career, like a lot of academics, producing arguments, I've had the delightful experience of telling some stories, and telling one story in particular. And I'm sorry if this sounds a little bit too much like an advertisement, but next month I'm going to be telling a few stories about this story, about the book that I've just published, whose subject is the life, as Olaf has said, of the first Copernican, Georgio Achim Reticus. And I want to begin today narratively with a scene from that book in which we meet Copernicus and one or two of the people to whom in his own lifetime Copernicus really mattered. Now, of course, one of these people is Reticus. So this, you can, if you like, treat this as a little bit of a Reticus trailer for the lecture that I'm advertising briefly there. That's kind of the end of the advertisement. This is for the geographers and others in the room so that you can orient yourselves, because I want to begin in a small town today known as Fromborg. Historically, depending on what language you were speaking, went under a number of names. In German, it is Frauenburg. And one of the peculiarities of Copernicus, and I don't want to get into nationalistic debates, but one of the peculiarities of Copernicus is that although he was Polish, his native language was, in fact, German. And writing a book about Copernicus and Reticus, one is always dodging potholes, because if you call something by the wrong name, you'll either offend the Poles or the Germans or somebody else. So I hope nobody will be offended by my geographical nomenclature. And the date is Thursday, May 24th, 1543. The 70-year-old man stretched out on the disheveled surface of the bed already looked half dead, literally. Pressure from a cerebral hemorrhage had caused right lateral paralysis of his body, so that the eyelid and cheek on that side of his face sagged lifeless. And the eyes that had gazed so deeply into the beauty of the universe no longer seemed to those present to see across the room, nor to discern the movements of people who entered it, let alone the time of day or the procession of the seasons. Like many in their last days, Nicolaus Copernicus left his attendants questioning whether his mind and spirit were even still there. Georg Donner, the other man in the room, had been tending his patient since late autumn of the previous year when Copernicus had suffered a stroke. Their close friend and former fellow canon, Tiedemann Giese, Bishop of Culm, residing 70 miles away in Lübau, had heard the bad news and on December 8, 1542, dashed off a letter to Donner in Frauenburg, entreating him to look after our revered old Copernicus. When he was in sound health, Giese wrote, he loved spending time alone. and for this reason I fear he may have but few friends who will stand by him now in his illness. Though we all owe so much to his upright character and outstanding instruction, please then, as his condition dictates, watch over him and care for this man whom you and I together have always loved. More than 5 months after that letter, on May the 24th, Donner was still faithfully watching and caring. As he would report to Giza, in all appearances, Copernicus's memory and mental powers had abandoned him already. Nevertheless, on this Thursday, in the late spring of 1543, Georg Donner still hoped, while a little life remained, to reach his dying friend with some gesture of closure or consolation. To those who had known Copernicus, he was many things: a professional administrator, a sought-after economist, a paragon of humanist learning, and above all, a skilled doctor. But almost nobody had an inkling of how history would remember him as the preeminent astronomer who, in the words of one Wittenberg theologian, moved the earth and immobilized the sun. Most of those acquainted with Copernicus had only sketchy notions of his deep commitment to the science of the heavens, and an even dimmer grasp, if any, of his radiant cosmological idea. This was hardly surprising. Copernicus was technically an amateur astronomer. By the way, I've got into some trouble for this claim, but it's true. He was an amateur astronomer. Unlychis most famous successors, Tycho Brahe, Kepler, Galileo, Newton, Copernicus was never paid for his science, nor ever granted any patronage to help him pursue it. Not once since his student days in Italy had he ever delivered a lecture on celestial mechanics or mathematics in any academy or university. Some 30 years before, in the second decade of the 16th century, he had circulated a manuscript containing his radical core ideas about a moving earth and a stationary sun, but nobody seemed to respond or to pay him the slightest attention. That was still the state of things when 4 years earlier, 25-year-old Georg Joachim Rheticus became aware of the theories of the elderly amateur astronomer and felt compelled to investigate them firsthand. A mathematics professor from Martin Luther's University of Wittenberg, Rheticus, whose own father, a doctor scientist, had been beheaded as a swindler and thief 11 years earlier, chanced the long pilgrimage to Varmia in hopes of meeting Copernicus, and ended up staying with him for 2.5 years. His arrival in late May of 1539 threw both men into a state of astonishment. Rheticus, in hearing such world-bending ideas straight from the man he would eventually revere as a father, and Copernicus at acquiring a real student, the only one he would ever have. When Rheticus arrived in 1539, Georg Donner was not yet, like Copernicus, one of the 16 Frauenburg canons who administered the cathedral and that the bishop's deputies ran the province of Varmia. Varmia was a bishopric. It was an ecclesiastical province. But Donner already knew Copernicus well enough to be aware of his devotion to the heavens and to long hours of private study. And he may have heard about a letter that Copernicus had received from a cardinal in Italy urging him to expound his new cosmology, though such expressions of interest were very rare. Especially in Varmia and Prussia, not exactly renowned for their intellectual ferment, anyone hearing rumors of the old canon's incredible theory that the earth was twirling about in the heavens would simply have ignored it or laughed it off as a product of creeping senility. People often underestimate how hard it would have been to believe that the earth is in motion. Rheticus, however, had the imagination, the mathematics, and the desire to think his way into Copernicus's new world. Indeed, for him, the experience was much like an infatuation, except that the beautiful face that obsessed him, held him captive, absorbed his mind and his waking hours, belonged not to a person, but to the cosmos. As a result, Rheticus grew exhausted and pale in those early summer months of 1539. Yet by autumn he had rallied and quickly began hatching grand schemes for heralding his teacher's vision of beauty. In early 1540 he launched a Copernican trial balloon of his own, publishing in nearby Danzig a brilliant précis, or first account, narratio prima, of the new cosmology, replete with respectful language about honoring one's predecessors. Then the intrepid Rheticus wasted no time sending copies of the small volume out to key readers, not only to the Catholic bishop in Heilsberg and the Protestant duke in Königsberg, but also farther afield, to a famous cartographer in the Low Countries, to his closest astrologer friend, away to the southwest on the borders of Switzerland, and most decisively, to one of Germany's leading scientific publishers, Johannes Petraeus of Nuremberg. Not that anybody actually believed what Rheticus presented of his teacher's cosmological ideas, and yet firm written evidence of serious curiosity on the part of scholars around Europe was enough. Together with continuous encouragement by Rheticus and Giza, and similarly documented eagerness on the part of the Nuremberg publisher, that serious curiosity tipped the scales. Copernicus at last agreed to share his work with the world. This meant finishing it, as well as transcribing a manuscript that his only disciple could deliver to the printing house. This, from 100 years later, is by an artist named Salarios. This is his symbolic depiction of Rheticus looking at his model of the universe and writing it all up, like a good scientist looking at his experimental results, although they weren't experimental. So Copernicus had to finish his manuscript, and his only disciple was then in charge of carrying it to the printing house. Everything now went according to Rheticus's plans, and by early autumn of 1541, when he was ready to leave Frauenburg and bid a final farewell to his beloved teacher, the astronomical life's work of Copernicus was carefully packed for the long journey south. Rheticus's apostolic mission to Nuremberg then encountered a series of difficulties. In December 1542, when the difficult publication process was still far from complete, Copernicus suffered his stroke. Moreover, by this time, Rheticus was beginning a new academic position in Leipzig and unfortunately had to leave supervision of the printing to someone else. Finally, in April of 1543, the great work emerged from the presses and was made ready for delivery. And by early May, a copy of the work had arrived in Frauenburg. Gunnar knew of the arrival of this book from Nuremberg, though at first he may have thought little of it, given Copernicus's low state of health. But on May 24th, remembering Rheticus, and the exertion and exhilaration of that unlikely paternal filial enterprise, Dunner decided to perform a remarkable gesture. He sent for the copy of Copernicus's masterpiece, of which you see here on the right the title page. At the top of the rather spare title page, the author's name appeared in block capitals, Nicolaus Copernicus of Torun, followed in smaller type by the work's subject and title, On the Revolutions of the Heavenly Spheres. This book, Donner sensed, would be Copernicus's chief legacy and monument. For himself, he would cherish his own personal copy, presented and signed by Rheticus, to my friend, the Reverend Mr. Georg Donner, Canon of Varmia, as you. And this is actually the title page of the copy that Rheticus later gave to Georg Donner, his friend, canon of Varmia. The writing in the middle, above the publisher's name, which is Johannes Petraeus of Nuremberg, indicates its later provenance, owned by the Jesuit College of Braunsburg. This copy, if you're a bibliophile like me, it now resides in the University Library of Uppsala, Sweden. And it's been there for some hundreds of years. My ancestors, the Swedes, stole it and took it for safekeeping to Sweden. And it's a good thing that they did. But that's another story. So Donner now has the copy of, not this particular copy, but another copy of the De Revolutionibus. And although he had every reason to doubt whether the book's semi-paralyzed and gravely ill author could any longer comprehend his surroundings, Donner carefully placed the recently arrived work in front of Copernicus so that he could see it. Donner would later tell Giza, who repeated it to Rheticus, that Copernicus did see it. And only a short while after those fresh pages were placed on his bed, Copernicus took a labored last breath and was silent. I began the book with this story because I'd so often heard this story referred to as if it were mythological. And in fact, I haven't read all my footnotes to you, but it's a well-attested story that one can find good historical support for. All right, let's fast forward, just to lighten the tone a little bit as well. Let's fast forward from May 1543 to January 2007. The American Dialect Society has just announced its Word of the Year for 2006. And that word is the verb to Pluto. To Pluto, to demote or devalue someone or something, as happened to the former planet, Pluto, when the General Assembly of the International Astronomical Union decided Pluto no longer met its definition of a planet. Now, some of my students are here, and you've heard this from me before. I'm so pleased with the American Dialect Society's choice. It's appropriate in many ways. If you think about it, in classical mythology, Pluto has all sorts of lovely underworld associations, or perhaps unlovely underworld associations, hell, Hades, Dis. And I think it's so nice that now there's an alternative verb to the popular verb to dis. So it was that at last fall's IAU meeting in Prague, Pluto was demoted, brought down in the world. Poor Pluto got dissed. Or to bring it full circle, Pluto got Plutoed. Now this sort of vocabulary of demotion dovetails neatly with my own involvement with Copernicus. Since 2001, I've been conducting a personal campaign. I can't overdramatize this. I've been conducting a personal campaign to correct what I consider a wrong reading of the significance of Copernicus for history and for human culture at large. This wrong reading takes the form of what I call the great Copernican cliché. Forgive me if you've heard this all from me before. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on it. The great Copernican cliché goes something like this. Before Copernicus, everyone thought that the Earth was the center of the universe and therefore very special. But along came Copernicus and taught that Earth was just an ordinary planet revolving around a central sun. That really got the ball rolling because subsequent scientists showed that the sun was just an ordinary star among billions of others, and even the Milky Way was just one galaxy among billions of other galaxies. Thus, the whole course of the history of astronomy increasingly shows that we are very small, not unique, and not special. The standard view suggests, therefore, that Copernicus dethroned the Earth from its position of cosmic significance. And henceforth, it was the role of scientists to make us feel bad about ourselves. As Terence Deacon puts it, since Copernicus first suggested that terra firma might not be located in the center of the cosmos, most of the remaining vestiges of human specialness have come into doubt. Sigmund Freud repeatedly spoke of Copernicus's, quote, outrage against humankind's naive self-love. And of course he presented his own work as Copernican, in a sense, that also heroically militated against such narcissism. Perhaps most famously of all, Carl Sagan described Copernicanism as the first in a series of great demotions delivered to human pride. When I first started grumbling about this cliche 6 years ago, I would invite audiences to go home, and not during my lecture, but afterwards, and to Google Copernicus and dethroned in the same field, of course, knowing that they would find a great range of exactly the bad examples I was complaining about. Well, in preparing for the lecture today, I've tried that little search again myself, and I've actually been relatively pleased with some of the results, because some of the results that come up are reflections of my campaign. This isn't pure vanity. You know that you can Google yourself and find all sorts of odd contexts in which you appear. But at least to a degree, my message seems to have been getting out, even if journalists are using my critique without acknowledgement. In the Jackson Sun newspaper, in case you haven't read it recently, in the Jackson Sun newspaper of Jackson, Tennessee, for example, a journalist known simply as the Science Guy has written the following. Carl Sagan confidently declared that the heliocentric theory of Copernicus was one of the great demotions delivered to human pride. Students are often taught that Copernicus somehow dethroned mankind from a privileged position at the center of the universe. This, however, is not correct! Exclamation mark. Well, good for the Science Guy, and I'm really not bitter that he doesn't give me a footnote, as long as the cliché is being placed under critical scrutiny. Though more often still, it is in fact still merely being parroted. Less than a week ago, Princeton University announced that faculty members from 13 departments were gathering to study the question of what it means to be human. And who could object to that? But right away, one of these 13 professors commented that, quote, just like the Earth was dethroned as the center of the solar system after Copernicus, so human intelligence is being gradually dethroned as the most perfect form of rational processing. End quote. So I haven't tipped the balance, but there's a little bit of, at least in Jackson, Tennessee, there's a bit of good influence being spread around. In Princeton, anyway, let me briefly summarize three aspects of my critique of the Copernican cliché. First, and I always like to begin with the most obvious, you can't dethrone something that wasn't on a throne to start with. In most medieval and Renaissance interpretations of Aristotle's and Ptolemy's cosmology, Earth's position at the center of the universe was taken as evidence not of its importance, but to use a term still in circulation, its grossness. Think of how your kids use the term gross, and you get an idea of how the medieval thought viewed the center of the universe. My favorite expression of this view is found, perhaps ironically, in Giovanni Pico's Oration on the Dignity of Man. Our present dwelling place, the earth, he wrote, is the excrementary and filthy parts of the lower world. Our location, you could say, with literal accuracy, is the pits. Or something else Pico's language suggests that rhymes with pits. And therefore, for Copernicus to declare that Earth was revolving about in the heavens constituted not a demotion, but a promotion. This is something that Galileo understood very well. Galileo exclaimed that in the Copernican system, Earth was no longer excluded from the dance of the stars. It no longer needed to be regarded as the sump where the universe's filth and ephemera collect. And the word I've translated sump is sentina, which was a word in Galileo's time which was used for the place below the lowest deck of the ship where the bilge waters collect. We're not there anymore. We're revolving about in the heavens, according to Copernicus. Secondly, and this is really the same point looked at from a different angle, what Copernicus had to worry about in his own time was the possible charge that his cosmology demoted the sun and placed it in a location of disrepute. His heliocentric theory, in other words, ran the risk of seeming to Pluto the sun. And if the International Astronomical Union last year created a lot of hurt feelings and expressions of shock by demoting little Pluto, which was only discovered a century ago, think how Copernicus might have looked against the backdrop of 2,000 years of scientific, artistic, religious, poetic tradition in which the sun was the most venerated heavenly body of them all. Nevertheless, Copernicus used poetry to bolster his scientific theory. One of the most famous passages he ever penned appears in Book 1, Chapter 10 of the Revolutions. In an outburst of figurative literary language, Copernicus writes, "And behold, in the midst of all resides the sun. For who in this most beautiful temple would set this lamp in another or better place, whence to illuminate all things at once? For aptly indeed do some call him the lantern, and others the mind or the ruler of the universe. Hermes Trismegistus calls him the visible god, and Sophocles Electra the beholder of all things. Truly indeed does the sun, sol, as if seated upon a royal throne, solium, govern his family of planets as they circle about him. Thus we discover in this orderly arrangement the marvelous symmetry of the universe and a firm, harmonious connection between the motion and the size of the spheres." Copernicus in this way honors the sun by calling it lamp, lantern, mind, ruler, visible god, beholder of all things, and royal governor. And in so doing, he aims to avoid, or at least blunt, what could have been one of the most serious objections to his theory. Anticipating the charge that he was dishonoring the sun, Copernicus deftly reconstrues the center. I like to use the expression, he's renovating the basement, and it becomes a place of honor, a place of effective, efficient government. Using a poetic play on words, he imagines it as a throne, solium, fit for the sun, sol. With the sun in the center, the pathways of the planets at last make sense. They exemplify the sort of beauty that something called a cosmos ought to embody. The sun's and the planet's astronomical truth reflects poetic truth. Rheticus, Copernicus' student, uses the same governmental analogy to support the Copernican claim that the sun is at rest, that it does not move about like a planet. "My teacher," says Rheticus, "is aware that in human affairs, the emperor need not himself hurry from city to city in order to perform the duty imposed on him by God. As Rheticus declared, while we were unable from our common theories even to infer this rule by the sun in the realm of nature, we ignored most of the ancient encomia of the sun as if they were merely poetry." But the encomia, the songs of praise, are nothing less than poetry. And in fact, they turn out to be not distractions from reality, but signposts pointing toward it. The similes and metaphors of the sun as ruler are themselves clues to the real physical structure of the sun and the universe. Copernicus's system does imply that the sun occupies literally the lowest possible cosmic location, that in Rheticus's words again, it has descended to the center of the universe. Nevertheless, the fitness, beauty, and glory of the sun in this reconfigured cosmos more than compensate for that lowering. Again, in the words of Rheticus, having exchanged places with the sun, the earth was now risen in the world, the earth was now risen in the world, promoted to the status of a star, and moves among the planets as one of them. Thus, do Rheticus and Copernicus together achieve the monumental feat of raising the status of both earth and sun within the same bold cosmology. And that doesn't sound to me like a dethroning. The third aspect of the Copernican cliché that I'd like to critique has to do not with Earth's location, but with its size. Copernicus offered grounds for believing the universe to be much larger than it was previously understood to be. Ptolemy taught that Earth was as a point, immensely, immeasurably small in comparison with the sphere of the fixed stars. Copernicus, however, realized that the same could be said of the entire orbit of the Earth about the Sun, which implied that the universe, by volume, and you can actually do the calculation if you borrow 16th century figures, this implied that the universe was approximately 2 billion times larger by volume than even Ptolemy thought. And of course, after Copernicus, cosmic vistas continued to expand exponentially. According to Stephen Hawking, the modern picture is one in which the Earth is a medium-sized planet orbiting around an average star in the outer suburbs of an ordinary spiral galaxy, which is itself only one of about a million galaxies in the observable universe. I admit freely that this picture is a powerful one, and it does not conduce to human pride. I'm actually not interested in promoting any kind of cosmic megalomania as far as human beings are concerned. Winston Churchill once heard it said that one of his political opponents was a humble man, and his immediate retort was, "Yes, with much to be humble about." So let's simply admit that, cosmically speaking, we have much to be humble about. Often one hears a sort of straw man form of argument in which those who think there's any human significance in the universe are just puffed up with pride somehow. On the other hand, let's not reduce our thinking to the level of those who send out spam emails that try to convince you that bigger is always better. Literal greatness, size, does not entail figurative or axiological greatness, excellence, or importance. And literal smallness does not entail insignificance. How often through history have poets searched for metaphors to express how worth may be embodied in tiny things? How love is not something merely bound by space or physical magnitude. How a jewel may dwarf in value the kingdom that contains it. Of course, Carl Sagan is right that Earth may, from one perspective, be a pale blue dot. But doesn't it also fill us with awe to contemplate, if we can, the inestimable riches concentrated in that small point of reflected light? I'd like to consider now another of the ways Copernicus's poetic, aesthetic approach to cosmology was fruitful. And in this particular case, his approach is also explicitly theological. In the preface to the De Revolutionibus, Copernicus complains of the poor results offered up by his astronomical predecessors, who, he says, have failed to describe the form of the universe and the sure symmetry of the parts. Instead, they have been like someone attempting a portrait by assembling hands, feet, head, and other parts from different sources. These several bits may be well painted, but they do not fit together to make up a single body. Bearing no genuine relationship to each other, such components joined together would compose a monster, not a man. For his part, Copernicus says, I pondered for a long time this lack of resolution within the astronomical tradition. It began to irritate me that the philosophers could not agree on a more reliable theory concerning the motions of the system of the universe, which the best and most orderly artist of all framed for our sake, propter nos. Let me issue two disclaimers or clarifications at this point. I'm not about to tell you that Copernicus was a proto-intelligent design theorist. He did not claim to infer the existence of an intelligent designer from the evidence of nature. Rather, he assumed the existence of an intelligent designer, and this assumption stimulated him to seek design, order, and meaning in the creation. And likewise, to be dissatisfied when others produced models of the universe that lacked these qualities. To put this in slightly different words, in the case of Copernicus, the assumption of an orderly creator was scientifically fruitful. And I would suggest further, without attempting to do natural theology, without treating the existence of a creator as a conclusion, that it is rational to prefer assumptions that do prove fruitful and that do lead to deeper understanding. This suggestion is very like the one summed up in the old saying of St. Anselm, Credo ut intellegam, I believe in order to understand. My second disclaimer on behalf of Copernicus is this. His phrase, for our sake, propter nos, need not imply merely for our sake. It need not imply a new non-geocentric form of anthropocentrism. In fact, the view of Copernicus I'm presenting is neither anthropocentric nor, on the other hand, to borrow C.S. Lewis's term, anthropo-peripheral. I think there's no compelling reason to conclude from our size or from our location in the universe that we are not special in some sense. And that can be very modest in some sense. Indeed, most scientists following in Copernicus's footsteps explicitly or implicitly acknowledge that for our minds to be able to grasp the laws of physics by which the universe operates is very special indeed. And also, it would seem, highly mysterious. One of the reasons Copernicus matters is that he, along with his most famous followers, Kepler, Galileo, and Newton, had the nerve to think that by measuring and examining the creation, they could gain some genuine insight into the mind of the Creator. Their theism encouraged a hermeneutic that was not satisfied with mere surfaces, mere phenomena. It impelled them to read more deeply, to seek meaning. And who will say that they didn't succeed? To put this more broadly, Copernicus matters because he reminds us of the importance and the potential fruitfulness of certain kinds of assumptions. I've been emphasizing his interrelated poetic and theistic assumptions. Yet I acknowledge that there are certain assumptions one makes on a merely pragmatic basis. I gather that scientists do this all the time. And actually, one of the reasons I like physicists so much is that they are capable of laughing from time to time at their own tendency to make overly simplistic assumptions for the sake of economy of explanation. Perhaps most of you have heard the story about the theoretical physicist who was charged with figuring out how to increase the milk production of cows. Although many farmers, biologists, and psychologists had tried and failed to solve the problem, the physicist had no trouble coming up with a solution on the spot. First, he began, we assume, a spherical cow. I was told by physicists the other day that they actually have this on a t-shirt, and it's one of their favorite garments. Sometimes, however, we get so used to employing certain simplified pragmatic assumptions that we follow them to their logical conclusions without re-examining the assumption's completeness or adequacy. Most science, for example, proceeds on the working assumption of purely natural origin and natural causation, and explicitly excludes explanations that employ the language of meaning or purpose, the language of teleology. And I'm not objecting to this procedure. However, if such assumptions are adhered to in a totalizing way, we shouldn't be surprised if they produce an overall picture of the world that is itself devoid of meaning and purpose. You could call this the spherical cow syndrome, if you like. Most famously, and quite seriously, 100 years ago, Bertrand Russell wrote that the world which science presents for our belief is one in which humankind is merely the product of causes which are but the outcome of accidental collocation of atoms. That no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. That all the labors of the age, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. Now, I present this passage with great respect for Russell, who's also, as you can see from the passage, a marvelous writer. But I would simply suggest that Copernicus, whose work stands at the beginning of much of the history of modern science, models some assumptions that are scientifically fruitful, but which do not logically or practically preclude a search for meaning that transcends as well as infuses the world of space, time, and causation. It is sometimes said that the pre-Copernican cosmology entailed a two-story universe. Below the sphere of the moon, as Aristotle taught, all natural motion was rectilinear and toward or away from the center. Moreover, one kind of stuff made up this sublunary realm, Aristotle's four elements, and another kind of stuff, ether or the quintessence, made up the superlunary realm, where all natural motion was circular about the center. Copernicus and his followers, however, showed that the world was qualitatively one universe that exhibited the same physics and the same geometry everywhere. That is why astronomers could pursue what Rheticus called God's geometry in heaven and on earth, and why Galileo, as we've already seen, could feel so exhilarated that earth had joined the dance of the stars. I would add that to be Copernican does not preclude the possible specialness of Earth in that cosmic dance. We may indeed have a unique role to play. We may indeed be in some cosmic sense special. It is in any case quite astonishing that anywhere in the universe there should be bits of the universe capable of reflecting on their own role in the universe. Let us not, in some parochial pre-Copernican way, leave Earth and its inhabitants out of our account of the cosmos simply because they are very small, or close at hand, or encircled by the sphere of the moon. I do not imply anthropomorphism or anthropocentrism by telling you that you are, as a matter of scientific fact, in the universe, and that no account of the universe will ever be complete if it leaves out your existence, your meaning, your purpose. The Copernicus I'm promoting, therefore, is a Copernicus who lifts our spirits and re-energizes a search for meaning within the cosmos. Famously, Goethe declared 200 years ago that no discovery or opinion ever produced a greater effect on the human spirit than did the teaching of Copernicus. No sooner was the Earth recognized as being round and self-contained than it was obliged to relinquish the colossal privilege of being the center of the universe. As you know already, I think Goethe was wrong. Of course, Earth is not the center of the universe, but why should that be interpreted so negatively with respect to the human spirit? Why interpret the history of science by means of a non sequitur? I propose that we simply, on good grounds, refuse to be Plutoed by that interpretation of Copernicus. The first time I ever visited New York City, I noticed a slogan on some billboards and on the sides of buses. And the slogan simply said, "Give a damn." In 1968, I, as a teenager from Victoria, BC, was shocked to see this kind of language used in public and paid for by the city government. But of course it was a plea to New Yorkers to care about their city, to treat it as if it mattered, and as if how they behaved mattered to the city and to its future. And I actually can't help but admire that campaign. In retrospect, I much prefer it to one perhaps that was rejected by the city fathers that might have said, "You're only one of 10 million citizens in a city that's no longer even the largest metropolis in the world, and that in any case, with the passage of time, will disintegrate into nothing." Surely, "Give a damn" was the superior slogan if one wanted to promote a better city. And perhaps it's the better slogan for those of us who want to encourage a better world. Copernicus's legacy is important enough, I'm suggesting, that it's worth wresting out of the clutches of those who would appropriate it for the pessimistic purposes of diminishing the significance of Earth or its inhabitants, and whether those who do that appropriation intend the pessimism or not. Instead, let Copernicus serve, as is proper, the view of humanity and of our Earth that asks us to care for this amazing world and its inhabitants, to marvel at the preciousness of this remarkable little cosmic speck. I'd like to conclude with the words of someone who I think of as a Copernican poet. Just a few years ago, a since deceased Canadian scholar discovered some lost writings of the late 17th century poet Thomas Traherne. One of these pieces of writing sketches a scenario that partakes richly in the Copernican imagination and postulates someone viewing Earth from outer space in a way, I submit, that is truly Copernican. Thomas Traherne writes, "Had a man been always in one of the stars, or confined to the body of the flaming sun, or surrounded with nothing but pure ether, at vast and prodigious distances from the earth, acquainted with nothing but the azure sky and face of heaven, little could he dream of any treasures hidden in that azure veil afar off. Should he be let down on a sudden and see the sea and the effects of those influences he never dreamed of, such strange kind of creatures, such mysteries and varieties, such never heard of colors, such a new and lively green in the meadows, such odoriferous and fragrant flowers, such reviving and refreshing winds, it would make him cry out, 'How blessed are thy holy people! How divine, how highly exalted! Heaven itself is under their feet. The earth seems to swell with pride that it bears them all. All its treasures laugh and sing to serve them. Verily, this star is a nest of angels. This little star, so wide and so full of mysteries, so capacious and full of territories, containing innumerable repositories of delights when we draw near. Who would have expected, and who could have hoped for, such enjoyments? Thank you very much.
This was an inspiration. I'm sure you'll agree. Before you have the opportunity of commenting and asking questions, I'm empowered by the Executive Committee of the Graduate Faculty Christian Forum to offer a small, poorly wrapped token of our respect. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You may in fact see that it's something to assist your writing.
Oh. I'll take the implicit comments with a grain of salt.
Are there comments? Yes,
presumably part of the reason that Copernicus was interpreted the way it was, I'm asking a rhetorical question.
Sure.
Actually had to do with the church's response to this whole concept. I just wonder if that is true in terms of the way they received Galileo and so forth.
Sure. There's a strong tendency to read Copernicus, did his work in the early 16th century, through the lens of Galileo in the early 17th century. And the Galileo incident is so famous I'm not one to explain it away. There was a definite conflict there, and to a large extent, it was a territorial conflict, which has to be read in the light of the work of the Council of Trent, for example, which demanded a more literalistic reading of the scriptures that had been necessary or imperative before the Council of Trent. But we read Copernicus through that lens. And I find it quite amazing to read, well, I don't find it amazing anymore, it's become commonplace to me. Copernicus worked for the church. He wasn't a priest, but he was a canon, a church administrator. Cardinal Schoenbrich, who was in Italy, Cardinal of Capua, wrote to him asking him to divulge his cosmology. There's no flicker that he received any actual opposition to his ideas. There's one comment in a work that was written by Achilles Gasser that talks about potential opposition to Copernicus's view from the schools, which of course means the scholastics in the university, who were Aristotelians, because it did violate Aristotelian physical teaching. And he also makes a comment that, or as the monks might say, would be heretical. But there's no indication that anybody actually got up and charged Copernicus, and Rheticus was promoting Copernicus's views long after Copernicus was dead, and there's not a flicker of indication of opposition to his view from ecclesiastical circles. And the first glimmer I see of the great Copernican cliché is about the 1640s, and then it kind of takes off, particularly in France, where ecclesiastical issues were sore ones, and then it seems to take off in about the 1660s, and then by the time of Kant and Goethe, and of course 100 years later Freud, it's the only show in town. And nobody's actually going back and looking at what it actually meant to Copernicus and Rheticus and Galileo and Newton.
Just to clarify, you're arguing then that in the early 15th century, in the theological discourse around Copernicus and
yes.
that there's no registering of a kind of a philosophical opposition.
There's registering of philosophical opposition, but not theological opposition. The philosophical, Aristotle dominated the philosophical tradition, and because, according to Aristotle's physics, you have to have the heavy item in the center, Earth by definition being the heavy item, Copernicus is really explicitly contradicting that fundamental teaching of Aristotelian physics. And it was clear that, and actually that's one of the reasons it took so long to get off the ground. Copernicus did not provide a physics that would explain his astronomy. Not that Aristotelian physics really beautifully explained Ptolemaic astronomy, but there was a bit more of an overlap than there was between Aristotelian teaching and Copernican astronomy. There's a gentleman over here.
I'm interested in your point of view on how the Copernican revolution succeeded from the point of view of history of science, philosophy of science.
Right.
Because it seems that the Ptolemaic model, which was the prevailing paradigm for a couple thousand years, did try to answer various observations with various additional auxiliary hypotheses,
yes,
like C coordinates and E coordinates and so on and so forth. In fact, they could even account for the phases of Venus at one point in the Ptolemaic structure. And yet Copernicus had a kind of, I've heard it said that Copernicus was, that was a thought experiment, the heliocentric universe. And that it was some time, it was parallax, I guess, that eventually did end the Ptolemaic system. And it wasn't the phases of Venus, and it wasn't even Galileo. But the Copernican paradigm succeeded somehow. And from a, again, from a philosophical point of view, arguing either as a determinist or an inductivist, it was not as well supported, at least at the time.
That's true.
As the Ptolemaic system was.
That's true.
And yet it did succeed. And I was wondering what your view is on that.
Until about the time of, until about 1609, when Galileo first back-engineered a crude telescope and looked through it at the heavens. And not that that was a decisive, I mean, that was a key moment, but it didn't actually turn everything around all at once. You can count about, there are debates about this, but I think I can count 14 or 15 at the most bona fide Copernicans in all of Europe. So it didn't exactly take off like wildfire. This is already 70 years after the publication of, almost 70 years after the publication of De Revolutionibus. So you're absolutely right. And in fact, the most influential, or certainly the highest prestige astronomer in the late 16th century was Tycho Brahe, who also refused to accept that Earth was not in that place that Aristotelian physics said it ought to be. The Tychonic system is often treated as a sort of footnote on the way to, you know how we read history of science in this Whiggish way where everything is actually getting better and better, so we don't treat Tycho Brahe too seriously. But you're absolutely right. The Ptolemaic model was a finely tuned instrument. It in Copernicus's view, just was kind of ugly. It was Copernicus's strong sense of aesthetics and desire for seeing harmony in the world that the artifacts, the architect, the artist had created, that made him offended by the Ptolemaic system. It became a sort of what's the correct term? Anyway, it's a sort of complicated machine that is inelegant. In the Copernican system, let me just go back to it. This is a term I learned from a bona fide cosmologist last summer. In the Copernican system, the orbits of the planets increase monotonically with their distance from the sun. I hadn't known that word monotonic before. So they might not be exactly proportional. Kepler works a lot on that, as you perhaps know. But Mars has the briefest period, Mercury has the briefest period, Venus the next, Earth the next, Mars the next. So the period increases as they go out from the sun. And yeah, so there's a kind of harmony, a fitting symmetry, a common measure, is the term that both Copernicus and Rheticus used to describe this. The Earth's orbit, which we still call one astronomical unit, becomes the key that unlocks all of this almost random movement of the planets through the heavens. So the I'll just, if you're interested, I'll just show you another picture here. It'll take too long. Sorry. Those of you who are astronomers, or I'm not an astronomer, but I'm interested in this anyway. If you watch the movement of Mars across the sky, it moves and then it comes to a stop and loops back on itself and carries on. It's known as retrograde motion. And if things are moving in a good Aristotelian way in the heavens, that ought not to happen. It looks like it's, you know, thrown into reverse. And it's not uniform motion that you would expect if you're a good Aristotelian. And so there are various epicycles and equants, as you point out, that were concocted to explain this odd motion. But in Copernicanism, by taking seriously the subject position of the observer on what now becomes a planet, you can explain the movement of Mars in a way that is logical. Let me just try to show you this picture. It'll come. Let me take another question while the picture is on its way up.
Yes. You used some words and I really enjoyed them. When you said, I must believe in order to, so that I may understand, as an astronomer and a student of Carl Sagan too,
Yep. You've
taken that and turned it around the other way and said, in order to believe, I must understand.
Yes.
I must understand so that I can believe.
Right. Right.
Which side of that argument do you think Copernicus would accept, especially with his evocation as a chance?
Just give me a clue about what you mean by the last part of the question. That would help me a lot.
I think with his role in the church, it would have put him under some pressure. He didn't have challenge.
Oh, yes.
Small c.
Sure. That's a fair point. I mean, the preface from which I read is, after all, written to the Pope. So maybe one might suspect that Copernicus is sort of going through the motions, wanting to look good in the eyes of a religious authority. And that's always a possibility. I don't think he was simply trying to look good in the eyes of the Pope, but fair enough. We do measure our words depending on our main audience. I think there are ways in which Copernicus does believe that cause him or encourage him to look for certain things. I'm suggesting that by, and this, whether he inherited it or had some profound religious conviction of his own, he believed, as most people did then, he believed in a God who had created the heavens and the earth. And he would have assumed certain things about God, that God was a God of order, not of disorder. These are all basic scriptural principles. And believing that God was the God of order, I'm suggesting, encouraged Copernicus to look for order in the handiwork of the Creator. I'm not suggesting at all that there might not be other areas in which one looks for understanding in order to believe, that one sort of comes at things from the angle that Sagan comes at them. And I'm not Plutoing Sagan. He has a lot to say. I disagree with him very fundamentally. I've learned from hard experience, as well as from good common sense, that I should respect him. A few years ago, I gave a lecture at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. You know, but others might not. These are the people who run the Hubble space program, the telescope. And I made a bit of a frontal critique of Carl Sagan. And I got a lot of people angry at me because a lot of those top-notch astronomers had gone into astronomy in the first place because of the inspiration they'd received from Sagan. So I've learned respect. I'm in some ways wanting to provide a counterbalance. I've mentioned the spherical cow syndrome, where we begin with a certain number of assumptions, which we adopt them because they work. They lead to good conclusions, but then we take another step and we totalize them without going back and asking ourselves whether those assumptions, not whether they were correct, but whether they were complete. And that is where I think faith has a role to play, and I think it had a role to play in Copernicus. I really appreciate the question. Thank you.
There was one, I want to add one thing to that.
Yes.
The intro to Copernicus on Kepler, Kepler himself said he wanted to know the mind of God.
Yes.
I think placing God in the equation, the prophet has been accused of not doing, we want
to watch.
And as a student of Sagan, he encourages you to question things and you can question Carl Sagan.
Yes, absolutely right. Yes. And I've got huge admiration for Kepler as well, but I think he went a little bit over the top, and you know, the for all of its usefulness, the Mysterium Cosmographicum really is more than one would want to acknowledge. He really thought that he had some sort of hotline to the mind of God, and that's not what I'm promoting. You understand that.
I could take this in a slightly different direction. You were saying that in the old view, Earth was at the center and the sum of the universe.
Yes.
You think of Dante's vision of Earth,
yes,
at the center, and Satan at the center, and the navel of Satan at the center.
Yes.
And really underscoring God's vision. Now, thought of Dorothy Sayers' introduction to her translation of the Divine Comedy, which she compares the medieval and the modern worldview.
Right.
And makes the claim, and I'm simplifying here, that in that shift of worldview, there are losses and gains.
Yes.
And to find meaning in the cosmos and the universe and in our existence, in the modern paradigm, there are, as I said, losses where we could learn from the medieval worldview.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you comment on that at all?
It's a fair point. And just to go back to the first thing that you were saying, Dorothy, those of you who don't know, Dorothy Sayers has a wonderful introduction to her translation of the Inferno in the three-volume Penguin edition of the Divine Comedy, in which she lays out, in the most sympathetic terms, the medieval view. Of course, there were different medieval views, but I'm simplifying the medieval view. The other very attractive exposition of the medieval view is C.S. Lewis's The Discarded Image. And people like Dorothy Sayers and C.S. Lewis, you can tell they really would have preferred to live in that world. And it's attractive because you're reading about it from the point of view of not a convinced, but a warmly partisan, but nevertheless not dogmatic guide. I'm not one of those. I recognize that there are challenges, and the example of one who seems particularly challenged by all this that is usually trotted out is Pascal. The infinite space is terrifying him. You know, you've seen the quotations. So yes, I think there are new challenges in the Copernican and of course much more modern cosmos. There are new challenges. But a lot of the work that cosmologists are doing, the so-called examination of the so-called fine-tuning problem, work that's been done, and again, one doesn't want to be dogmatic about this, but about the so-called anthropic cosmological principle. It is fascinating stuff, and it invites us, without becoming full of narcissism and pride, to ask what is the role of creatures within the universe who, in spite of how small we are, nevertheless are capable of reflecting on the meaning of that. For the medieval universe, for the medieval mind, I think there was less a sense of wonder at that because it was a smaller cosmos. It wasn't exactly cozy, but it was smaller. Our cosmos is conspicuously not cozy. And that challenges us to raise the question of meaning and of purpose. But I just don't want to give up on that. That's why I'm trying to get rid of the sort of stick figure of science that I sometimes joke that it is rather ironic. And most scientists don't do this, in fact. But there are certain popularizing scientists who show that humankind is nothing. It's the merest speck of dust. And yet there's a sense in their rhetoric of, look what we've shown. Aren't we special, right? So there's kind of ironic reversal of pride taking pleasure in showing how we shouldn't be full of pride. But there are definite challenges. Anyone else? Okay. Well, my computer's decided not to show retrograde motion. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure to thank Dennis for his scholarly and enriching presentation. I think every time one is familiarized with a new individual, and I guess you in the audience would have been familiar with these people, but I have to confess Rheticus was a new and fascinating figure. And each time one hears of the struggles and the ways in which their science and their faith interacted, it makes one realize that we have a very partial view of our own created selves and of our own created context. And I want to thank you, Dennis, particularly for this presentation. It's a model of what the graduate faculty Christian Forum is trying to do. And I think it says exactly what I should have tried to say. It illustrates so well what we're trying to do. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.